MacCast, Tuesday, February 28th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be back here with you for another episode. Last week, I was out of town, so this is a little delayed, but we have a really great show for you coming up. A number of things to cover. We're going to cover some quick news, because I've got something kind of special going on in this episode, so it's going to be a little bit quicker. We're just going to cover some of the recent stories that have happened over the past couple days. I'm going to get to a couple of your questions and feedback, actually feedback and a couple tips. And then we're going to dive into an interview that I've been wanting to do for a little while. And that is reconnecting with Scott Johnson from the Frog Pants Network and of Nerdtacular fame, and also his webcomic, My Extra Life, and a whole bunch of other stuff. A great guy. But I wanted to check in with him because we talked to him a while back about some of his workflows and some of the stuff that he does. And I wanted to get a little update on that and see how he was doing and check in. So it was a great conversation. Very interesting. We talked about the future of Macs and Apple and the pro market, got into a little bit of gaming and VR augmented reality stuff because Scott's also a very big gamer and into that sort of thing. So I think it was a great conversation, and I think you'll find it very interesting. So we're going to do that. Also cover, you know, what's going to happen with next iPads and maybe the next iPhone, some of the new features there. Talk about Apple moving into their new spaceship campus. We've got details on what it's actually called now, and also an update on third-party repairs. Apple's changed some of the rules for doing repairs on your iPhone. And then, like I said, we've got feedback on the paste and match style thing we were talking about in the last episode, and a couple of great tips from one of our listeners. And I've got an interesting bit of news surrounding the Apple Car. So stay tuned for that along with Scott's interview. But before we get into all of it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. It's their mission to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, and they achieve that by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. And we have been enjoying Blue Apron meals at my house for a couple weeks now. Just this week, after I got back from my trip, we had an awesome seared steak with roasted Brussels sprouts meal, and also a really great chicken and rice casserole. And one of the wonderful things that we like about Blue Apron is just the variety of meals that you get. And you get to pick and choose each week what you want from that variety. So they present a number of recipes. You can have them pick for you and just, you know, be surprised by what comes if you're more inclined to do that. Or if you're like me, you want to go in each week, check out what the recipes are, and then figure out what you're going to want. And the variety's been great. And in fact, recipes are not even repeated within a given year. So you're going to get all new recipes. And it's great when you're trying to actually learn. And that's been another one of the great benefits about Blue Apron for us, is we're learning all these kinds of new recipes. I think I mentioned last time how we're getting into all kinds of new ingredients and flavors that we haven't tried before. It's really expanding the palate of my kids, which they've been historically picky eaters. But I think because of the whole experience, because it's sort of this, you know, what's going to come this week, what sort of interesting things are going to come, they're kind of into it, and they're kind of into and more open to trying stuff. And that was a really big surprise to me. I wasn't expecting it, but it's been a huge benefit of having Blue Apron. And we're becoming better cooks because you get, you know, these great recipe cards that come along with it with all of the steps, and you learn new cooking techniques. And so that goes into that part of what they're talking about of building a community of home chefs. And just the idea of being able to sit down at a meal together and do that, that has been really great for our family as well. So we're enjoying all of that, and I'd like you to be able to try and enjoy that as well. So you can do that completely free. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free along with free shipping by going to blueapron.com MacGyver.com/MacCast. And you will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/MacCast. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And a big thanks to Blue Apron for supporting the MacCast. It's pretty much believed in the rumor mill lately that the next event Apple is going to have is going to be an iPad event. I know a lot of us are probably hoping that we're going to get a Mac event as well. Maybe some updates to iMacs, maybe MacBooks. How about a Mac Pro? That's some of the things that Scott and I are going to get into a little bit later. But right now, it's looking like iPads are going to be the thing. And it seems like this past week just reaffirmed to me what we already knew about Apple rumors, which is pretty much nobody has any real idea what's going on, but they'll just regurgitate whatever rumors are flying out there anyway. And I'm joking a little bit because you can kind of take all these rumors, put them together, and maybe figure out exactly what's going on. But Apple is often doing a lot of things with prototypes, and they're putting a lot of information out there, I think, to kind of, you know, make the rumor mill a little bit muddy so we don't know exactly what's going on. But first, we have Mac Takara. I always worry that I'm getting that wrong. So if anybody knows the actual pronunciation, I think that's how you pronounce it. They say that there will be an iPad Pro event in March and that Apple will announce three new models, a 7.9-inch iPad, a 9.7-inch iPad, a 10.5-inch, and a 12.9-inch model. I even had that wrong size in my notes, which is why I messed up. So three new models, 9.7-inch, 10.5-inch, which is going to be the new size and form factor, and a new 12.9-inch. So all iPad Pros. The 9.7 and 12.9-inch models, they're saying, are going to ship in March, followed shortly by the 10.5-inch model in May. So they'll announce that new model, but it won't quite be shipping. And that's the one that's going to have an edge-to-edge design, supposedly no home button, be about the same size and form factor as the 9.7-inch model is currently. And they're also reporting, this is interesting, that at that same event, Apple will update the iPhone SE. So a lot of people have been wondering and asked me about the iPhone SE. It's looking like that may get a bump and it may include a new storage size. So I think currently you can get the iPad or the iPhone SE in a 16 gigabyte and a 64 gigabyte, if my memory serves me right. And they're saying there's going to be a new 128 gigabyte storage size along with a new red color. And I would assume that would be a product red version of the iPhone SE. So you had that going on. And then later in that same week, DigiTimes comes out and reports that both the 10.5-inch and the 12.9-inch models may not ship until May or June. So they're believing that there is going to be an event, but that only the 9.7-inch model would be available to ship right away. And the other Pro models, the 10.5 and 12.9-inch models, would come later. Another thing that the rumor mill can't seem to agree about is the screen resolution of this new 10.5-inch iPad. Earlier reports had claimed that it would have the same resolution as the 12.9-inch iPad Pro, 2732 by 2048, with the same pixel density as the iPad Mini, which would be 326 pixels per inch instead of the 264 pixels per inch of the 9.7-inch iPad. Now, more recent rumors are claiming that the resolution is actually going to be 2,224 pixels by 1,668 pixels, and that it will have the same pixel density as the 9.7-inch model, that 264 pixels per inch. So what we actually get, who knows? The more recent rumor is that it's the lower pixel density with a slightly different resolution than the 12.9-inch iPad. Personally, I'm hoping the first rumor is more accurate because it makes sense that if they can take that same resolution, cram it in a smaller screen, get a higher pixel density, that we're going to have a much nicer display. I guess one of the only concerns would be, are your icon sizes and targets and things like that going to get too small if you kind of shrink that down? But I don't think it will. I think you can get you know, the 12.9-inch resolution in a 10.5-inch display, and it will work out fine. A few other things that we know from various sources about what we might see at the iPad event. The 12.9-inch iPad is expected to get a bump up to a 12-megapixel rear camera and a True Tone display, just like the 9.7-inch iPad Pro. I don't know why I keep translating. I must have a little bit of dyslexia. I keep transposing those numbers in my notes, so I apologize for that. The 9.7-inch model will get a smart connector, a True Tone display, 4 speakers, and a 12-megapixel rear-facing EyeSight camera, along with a True Tone flash. And it's believed that the 9.7-inch model could possibly become the new lower-cost version of the iPad Pro, retaining the A9X chip that's in the current model, and then the new 10.5-inch would sort of replace the existing 9.7-inch, and then you'd have the 12.9-inch with its updates, and both of those would feature Apple's A10 processor, sort of rounding out the top end of the iPad Pro line. So you're going to have 3 iPad Pros, kind of the low-cost entry model, and then the 10.5-inch and the 12.9-inch. And the 10.5-inch might be that sort of sweet spot between resolution and size, and I think that is maybe what Apple is going for. Similarly, that's kind of what they seem to be going for with the iPhone 8. But as far as when we might hear about these new models, it's looking like some sort of an announcement in March, obviously because of the discrepancy between the early rumors, when we actually get to go into an Apple store and buy those models, that is certainly up for debate. The next iPhone may be able to see in 3 dimensions. You know, certainly Apple has acquired a ton of companies who are focused on facial recognition technology lately, and now speculation is that Apple wants to use those skill sets to develop sensors and technology in the camera for future biometric or possible augmented reality applications. This past week, Apple analyst Ming-Chi Kuo said that some of the tech might show up in a, quote, revolutionary front camera and infrared module. So this is looking to be some sort of selfie, like 3D scanning sort of thing, more than maybe an augmented reality technology, although it could be used for both. But they're saying it's going to be on the front-facing camera. And the idea here is that the camera could take depth information and then merge that with 2G images to do all sorts of cool stuff like facial recognition, iris recognition, and yes, even building out 3D models. Applications could be, of course, security enhancements to the current biometrics of the Touch ID fingerprint scanner, and we had been hearing about facial recognition and iris recognition possibly coming to the new iPhone. Some had speculated that it may actually replace Touch ID. I'm kind of hoping that that is not the case, because I think Touch ID is the perfect biometric. The idea of sort of holding the phone up to my face or having to do some sort of retina scan where I've got to get it near my eyeball where it can actually see it. I guess it depends on how that technology works. If it can work at odd angles and work from a distance, maybe. But I'm seeing it more as an additive sort of thing. So maybe for specific applications, things where you want a second layer of security or a higher level of security, a combination of fingerprint plus facial recognition or iris recognition could be cool. But then the other fun stuff for this is, again, this idea of being able to kind of create an on-the-fly 3D model just from the camera. So imagine that you take the camera, you hold it up, it can actually image capture or 3D capture your face, your head, and then put that on a character in a game that you're playing. So you really can enter the game and your character is going to look like you. So these are the kinds of applications. And of course, Apple hopefully would open up an API, third-party API to developers, and you could do some very interesting things. It'd be kind of cool, I was thinking, if you could scan personal objects and use those as elements within a game or within an application or something like that. So certainly the technology is there, and Apple has been acquiring companies that could help them realize it. The camera is said to also be able to detect the location and depth of objects, so you can see where it could have some interesting applications for augmented reality. But again, I think the EyeSight camera would be better for that sort of application. I can't imagine kind of what kinds of augmented reality applications you would want with a selfie or a front-facing camera, but maybe I'm just not thinking wildly enough. But did I mention the sensor? It uses freaking lasers. I guess the way it works is there's an infrared transmitter that will apparently be used for vertical cavity surface emitting laser technology. It works by sending out an IR light signal from the phone and then detecting that signal that bounces back off objects using a 1.4 megapixel infrared receiver. And supposedly Sony is going to create the front-facing camera. They've been doing that for a while, so that's not a surprise there. But then the IR receiver technology would be made by Sharp, which is now part of Foxconn. So a little combination of efforts there. And then the software is actually using algorithms from PrimeSense, which is a company Apple acquired in 2013. And that could be combined with some of the facial recognition technology they acquired from Mateo, which is a company they picked up in 2015. So you can see how they're kind of combining some of those skill sets potentially into these new features that are going into the phone. Now, again, as far as what we're going to see with a new iPhone, it's still expected. Again, there's going to be three models. A 4.7-inch iPhone 7S is what people are calling it. So sort of an update, same form factor as the iPhone 7, but with updated internals, and then you would get an iPhone 7 Plus, 7S Plus, which would be the 5.5-inch design. Again, same design as the current iPhone 7 Plus, but with upgraded internals. And then you would have this brand new design of an iPhone, what many are calling the iPhone 8, supposedly an all-glass edge-to-edge design. It will actually have a 5.2-inch display area and then some sort of touch area replacing the home button. I'm personally thinking it's going to be something like the touch bar that we've seen on the new MacBook Pros, but that's just my own speculation. It's only ever been referred to as sort of this touch area that would be in the place of where the current home button is. And again, no home button on this new design. So somehow the Touch ID technology is either going to have to be embedded into the display or into the touch area. And this is another reason why I think it's the touch bar, because as you know, the new MacBook Pro actually has a Touch ID sensor integrated into the touch bar. It's really hard to see, but it's right there on the one end. So I think Apple could do a similar design thing here with the iPhone 8. But again, a 5.2-inch display, even though it's being referred to as a 5.8-inch piece of glass. And what's even cooler is a bunch of people have calculated out the math, and even though it's 5.8 inches corner to corner, that actually fits into the same size as the current 4.7 inch iPhone 7. So you're going to have a larger display in the same form factor. And I guess I'm super excited about this because, as you know, I'm not a huge fan of the Gigantophone, the 5.5 inch plus. I tried it. It just wasn't the size for me. So to be able to get a new iPhone 8 and have it still be the same size as my iPhone 7, yeah, I'm super jazzed about that. It's also being rumored that Apple could bump up the RAM in the iPhone 8 to 3 gigabytes, up from 2 gigabytes, and that the model will come in just two sizes, a 64 gigabyte and a 256 gigabyte option. Though we had previously heard rumors that the new iPhone might have more storage, that they might bump up the storage. To me, that implied that we could see a 512 gigabyte version. But at this point, it's looking like, nope, it's still going to top out at 256. And then the Wall Street Journal this week caused a little bit of a ruckus when they ran a story that claimed Apple would be switching from Lightning to USB-C on this year's iPhone. Now, they didn't kind of get into a lot of details of this. This was kind of a small part of a bigger piece. But level heads prevailed because in the analysis and sort of after this story came out, Jason Snell and Jeff Gamet kind of, I think, found the right spin on the story. So it could be that what Apple is going to do is include a Lightning to USB-C cable in the box instead of a Lightning to USB-A. So you're still going to have a Lightning connector on the iPhone, and that's still going to be what you're plugging in on the iPhone side. But then on the other side, the thing that comes into the little wall wart charger that they give you, that would be a USB-C connector instead of a USB-A, and you would plug in there. And why would they do that? Well, because Apple is also moving, as you know, all of their laptops over to USB-C, and I think all future Macs are going to be using USB-C ports. So you're also going to want to be able to plug that in on the Mac side of things. And that was actually a big complaint for a lot of people with the new MacBook Pros and the new MacBooks with USB-C connectors, is that, well, now I can't plug in my iPhone to do charging or to do syncing. And this would solve that problem. Of course, for those of us with older model Macs, we're now going to have to get a USB-C to USB-A adapter, or, of course, just grab your old Lightning to USB cable. You're just not going to get one in the box with your new iPhone 8. And that seems logical to me. I think Apple could totally be doing that. But expect the USB-C connector to be on the opposite side of the iPhone, not the thing that you plug into the iPhone. That's going to be Lightning, at least for this generation, maybe a few more generations. I don't think Lightning's going away anytime soon. But that sort of wraps up the latest iPhone rumors. We now know what Apple is calling their new campus. It's been referred to in the community by many different names. The spaceship, also Apple Campus 2. It has now been officially named. Apple came out and said it is called Apple Park, and that employees will be moving in April. If you remember, construction began way back in 2013, and Apple had originally had a target date of completion in 2016, but numerous delays for various reasons, one of the big ones being Apple's just fanatical attention to detail, had caused it to push back the opening date. Now we know until April of this year. The new campus was actually built in collaboration with Forest and Partners, and it sits on 175 acres and is going to be powered by 100% renewable energy. And there was kind of an interesting stat I saw over on the Mac Observer. The space where the new campus sits used to be owned by HP. And when they did that, 25% of the space was like green spaces and landscaping. The other 75% was walkways and buildings and that sort of thing. With the new Apple spaceship design, they've actually flopped that. And 25% is sort of pavement and walkways and things like that. 75% of that space, that acreage, is actually greenways and lawns and trees. Apple brought in a bunch of trees. So Apple's been very much about the environment and the design. I mean, the whole center of the thing is a giant sort of greenway, green space, and it just looks beautiful. If you've seen any of the video flybys that have been floating around, it just looks gorgeous. And as a matter of fact, there was a 100-year-old barn on the property built in 1916. It's known to historians as the Glen Denning Barn, and it had been on the property since HP had it, and HP made sure that it stayed preserved, and Apple has made sure that that building has stayed preserved as well. I'm not sure what they're using it for. I think it came out that it might be some sort of storage shed or something like that, but they've taken care of it. They've left that in place. So they've been sort of very responsible about, you know, using the land and using the space. And they plan to move their 12,000 employees or move 12,000 employees to the new campus. The move is actually expected to take over 6 months to fully complete. And while they're doing that, they are actually going to be continuing construction on a couple of smaller buildings and facilities, continuing to add in and do landscaping and all that sort of stuff. So I think, you know, they've been kind of chomping at the bit. I think they're very excited, as you would be, to kind of get in there. And they are getting in as soon as possible. And we also heard that, you know, Tim Cook and all the executives and everybody are going to be moving their offices over there. And it should be really cool. There's also a new on-site theater. So when they have press events and things like that, special events and announcements, they're going to bring people into the new theater. And it was announced that it is going to be called, very appropriately, I think, the Steve Jobs Theater. And that is expected, they said, to open later this year. When that will be ready, I certainly don't think it's going to be ready for the next Apple announcement, but maybe by the time Apple in the fall is rolling out the new iPhones and making the new iPhone announcement, I bet you can fully expect that that will happen at the new Steve Jobs Theater. And that will be an amazing moment and an amazing day. And then the last thing with the new Apple Park that I was excited about and saw in the press release is that the site will also feature a couple of building spaces that are open to the public, including a new full Apple store and a cafe. So you're going to be able to go to Apple Park and get a bite to eat and maybe buy some Apple gear. And I'm hoping they continue the trend that they did with the Apple store on the at the old campus, where you can get apparel and gear and stuff like that. I have a feeling it'll still be the place where you can go get an app, and the one and only place where you can still go get an Apple t-shirt. So I was excited about that because early reports had said that there was not going to be an Apple campus store at the new facility. But it sounds like there is, and there is an open cafe. And in the past, with the current campus, if you wanted to get into Cafe Max, you had to know an employee, you had to know somebody to actually get in there. So there is going to be at least one open cafe for the public, and that's pretty cool. So expect a lot more visuals to the, I guess we really can now call it the mothership, the mother spaceship, Apple Park. Anyway, very cool and great announcement, and excited that Apple's going to be moving in there soon. And then one last little story to mention before we get into some feedback. Apple has okayed third-party iPhone screen repairs. Mac Rumors confirmed that an internal menu has changed the rules and says that now AppleCare warranties are not voided if someone has done a third-party screen replacement. In the past, putting on a third-party screen or having a third-party screen replacement installed actually voided your entire warranty. If you brought your phone in with some other issue, Apple would not look at it. They would not repair it. They would kind of send you away. Now what they'll do is they will continue to warranty any part that is not the display itself. Obviously, the third-party display, since it's not an Apple part, it was not installed by Apple, that would not be covered. But if you put the display in and then suddenly you're having a problem with the Lightning port and they need to swap that out or something like that, or a speaker or a microphone, that will be covered. And what they'll do is they'll take in your device, they'll inspect it, they'll confirm that there's not been any fraud or tampering, and then they will cover those things. If the presence of any third-party part causes the repair, though, to be unsuccessful or breaks the phone, Apple did say that customers would be required to pay the out-of-warranty cost to replace the third-party part or the entire device if necessary. So if somehow when they got in there to put in that screen, they did some other damage or caused other parts of the phone to be non-repairable, you're going to have to cover the full cost of the boat. And this new rule only applies to third-party screen repairs, meaning that any other part that comes from a third party, an aluminum enclosure, a logic board, a battery, lightning connector, headphone jack, volume buttons, mute switch, sleep-wake button, certain microphones, any of those things, if they get in and find those in your device, you will be declined for warranty service. So you probably want to make sure that when you get your iPhone repaired, still that you take it to an Apple store or an Apple authorized repair center to get the work done if it's still under Apple Care warranty. You know, once it's off warranty, then, you know, get your iPhone fixed wherever you want or prefer. But until then, I would still advise, yeah, stick with Apple or an Apple authorized repair center. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. And I want to tell you about Text Expander this week, but not just Text Expander, but Text Expander for Teams. So you already know how great Text Expander is for your personal use, and you likely have your own workflows and your snippets that are in there that you can't live without. You have to have them on every Mac. But what about sharing that experience with your office or your club or your work group? Well, that's where Text Expander for Teams comes in. It can beef up not just your own productivity, but the productivity of everyone that you work with. And wouldn't that be a great thing? Yeah, we want our coworkers to be just as productive as we are. It's nothing's more frustrating, you know, when you're pulling your weight and someone else isn't. So help them along and, you know, teach them and get them Text Expander for Teams. Because with Text Expander for Teams, the benefit is you can share snippets, and the best snippets from each team member can be shared. So you can kind of go through there. You can find the ones that work best. So imagine you've got Steve, right, in customer service, and he's great with these custom email responses, and he's built all these great workflows in Text Expander, fill-in fields, optional fields, all that sort of stuff. And he's just whizzing through support emails as, you know, quicker than anyone else. Well, why not let him share that with the rest of the team so that everybody on the team can get as good at replying to customer service emails as Steve? That's the kind of thing that Text Expander for Teams is going to enable. So how are you going to find the best snippets from your team members? Well, they are all immediately accessible and searchable through simple abbreviations and keyboard shortcuts so your team can find them. And plus, your team can use snippets on any computer or any device because Text Expander for Teams is available for Mac, iOS, and yes, now even Windows. So if you're in a mixed environment office, you can use Text Expander for Teams as well. If you want to check it out and start a free trial, just visit textexpander.com/Maccast. And there you can learn how companies such as WordPress and Desk have been able to multiply their productivity using Text Expander. So they have some great examples from some really big companies that are using Text Expander for Teams. So if you think this is something that you could use again for your office, for your club, for your school, for your work group, check it out. TextExpander.com/Maccast. And a big thank you to Text Expander and Smile for their continued support of the Maccast. So on the last episode, we had a question about copying and pasting text and having it not retain all of its formatting, to actually be able to paste it into a new document. And if you're in a text document, have it be text only. Or if you're in some sort of page layout program and you've already got a style in there, you want it to match the style that you're pasting into. And I apologize because I made a mistake when I gave you the keyboard shortcut for paste and match style. So we all know Command V, or most of us, I think, know Command V is the shortcut for pasting. To be able to paste and match style into a document, I believe on the last episode, I told you the command was Command Shift V, the letter V for victory. That is incorrect. It's actually Command plus Option plus Shift plus V. And a big thanks to Corey for catching that error and letting me know about it. So I had that. But then also in that episode, I kind of threw it out to you for other suggestions, because the question was, how can I do paste and match style for the Command V? I want Command V to always do paste and match style. And is there a way to do that? So one of the recommendations that I had was just overriding and setting up your own shortcut, which you can do in the keyboard system preferences, and just mapping the paste and match style option to the Command V paste command. But a number of you wrote in with some great alternative suggestions. Adam wrote in to say that he uses Keyboard Maestro, which is this great macro application. You can set up all kinds of keyboard shortcuts, and not just shortcuts, but really complex macros, scripted actions using Keyboard Maestro. And I know a lot of people who really like this application. He created a bunch of great ones for pasting text in a bunch of different formats. So he has one where when you paste, the text comes out in all caps, or it comes out using sentence case or title case, or in this case, he also has one that will do just plain text. And he has shared them with us. So I will have a link in the show notes at maccast.com, and you can go get Adam's Keyboard Maestro shortcuts and load them in if you're a Keyboard Maestro user. If you're not, I have a link to Keyboard Maestro. and you can check out the software and see if it's something that you can use and fit into your workflow. And then you can grab Adam's great snippets. So Adam, thank you for sharing those with the community. Like I said, they'll be in the show notes at maccast.com. And then Skip wrote in with a similar kind of tip. He says, you know what, Adam, I use Text Expander snippet to do this. And this is another one of these cases. I've told you how great Text Expander is because I keep finding new and new scenarios where I can use it. And this is a great example of it. He said, you know, it's a really simple Text Expander snippet. If you go in to the snippet when you're setting it up, and in the content options, you just choose plain text and then tell it, I want to add the contents of the clipboard in. There's a little drop down. It's percent clipboard is the replacement string, but that's the contents of the clipboard. Put that in using the content option plain text into your snippet. And then what happens is that anything that you quote unquote paste by using that snippet will come in as plain text. So anything that any text that you've copied to the clipboard, even if it has rich text formatting or other kinds of formatting, it's going to get pasted in as plain text using whatever snippet you want to set up. So, you know, semicolon PT or something like that for your shortcut. And then anytime you type that, it's going to paste from the clipboard the plain text version of that. So that was another great tip from Skip. And then finally, I had a voicemail from Marcus, who is having a different kind of text replacement dilemma and wanted our help. So here's what he was asking about.
Hi, Adam. My name's Marcus from Cambridge in the UK. I've got a problem that's been driving me potty for ages now, and I cannot find a solution anywhere. So this is text replacement, which I've used now throughout Mac OS and iOS, also OS X and iOS, for some time now, and I like the way the text replacements sync across the devices, and it's always worked perfectly. And the most useful thing that I find that I use it for is website logins, so where you need to enter your email address to log in and a password. And my email address would be the double at symbol, and it would pop up and it would always work. Now, I think since Mavericks, it stopped working. So if you type my double at symbol in a login for any sort of website like Dropbox or Amazon, it won't work. Now, I've tried Googling an awful lot of websites and found no answers. I've also tried some of the other apps, and I know you're a great advocate of Text Expander. However, I don't have a great use for this kind of app. I only want it for a very limited number of shortcuts, so I don't really want to spend a lot of money on a replacement app just so I can fill in a few odd bits and pieces. Text replacement works perfectly everywhere else. I've tried all the simple solutions, like making sure that in the substitution menu in Safari that text replacement is switched on, but I would love you to investigate and find why it's not working. Just out of interest, I've also tried it in Dropbox, so if you Google Chrome. So if I fire up Google Chrome, try the same thing, and fire up Dropbox, go to the login screen, enter my email address, double at symbol, it won't work there either. I know there's something to do with secure input, but beyond that, my understanding is not very good. Love your show, keep it up, and I'm hoping you can provide an answer. Cheers.
Hey, bye. Well, Marcus, I think I'm about to let you down, unfortunately. I dug into this too and tested it, and sure enough, just like you said, using OS X's built-in text replacements in web forms, in text boxes on many web-based forms, I could not get the text to expand. And I don't know why that is. And it was generally inconsistent. I guess that was part of the frustration, and maybe part of your frustration as well. I noticed that if I was in a text area, you know, like a place where you could put in more than one line of text, it sometimes would work or mostly would work. And then I noticed on some websites, some just standard text input boxes, say like a search field or something like that, it would work in. For example, I think in Apple's search field on their website, I think it did work. But yet you go to other sites, just like you were saying, to like Dropbox login or Google or some other place, and the replacement just literally will not pop up when you're in that box. And I'm with you in this theory that maybe it's something related to security. Maybe if the text box is defined as an email input, that's what the issue is. But I even tried hacking that a little bit inside Safari and, you know, changing using the web inspector and developer tools, changing the field to a standard, you know, text input field instead of an email input field. And I did not have any different results. Now, that's a little bit unscientific because you'd probably actually have to go change the source code and not do it on the fly. It could be related to that. But, you know, my best guess as to what might be happening is that maybe when you're on a site that might be having like an autofill or might be watching a text input field for an event, like using some JavaScript, it's got a JavaScript event running that's maybe blocking or keeping the text expansion from working, the built-in OS X text expansion. But really, that's all I've got for you, and that's the only thing that I could come up with or think of. And I can confirm, I know this doesn't help you, but I can confirm that Text Expander in these situations performed as expected and just fine. But I get that you want to use the Mac OS X built-in method where you go into System Preferences, you go into Keyboards, and you click on Text, and you can create your own text replacements that sync across all your devices and stuff like that. Very, very handy tip and thing to use. And because it's built-in and free, you know, why not use it? But in this scenario, this one odd scenario, it's not working. So I don't have a definitive answer. What I'm hoping, though, and maybe you're hoping this as well, I'm hoping someone in our community will. So if you know an answer for Marcus and myself, why this is not working specifically inside a browser, inside a text input field, why can't we do expansions? And it's any expansion. It's not just email addresses. It's, you know, if you want to use the On My Way shortcut, which is built into that doesn't work either. None of the expansion happens inside these text boxes. So if you happen to know why that's happening, shoot us an email, audio comment, let us know, and I'll try and share that with you, Marcus, on a future episode. Someone will have the answer. Someone will know why this is the way it is. But thanks for sending in your question, and sorry I couldn't be of more help this time around. All right, next up, I want to share with you a couple of cool listener tips from Sonal. He sent these in, and I thought they were great. So here's a couple quick tips.
Hi, Adam. It's Sonal here from the United Kingdom. I wanted to share a few quick tips and also ask a question. Two quick tips for you. The first is that since Mac OS Sierra launched, you've been able to group windows within applications together in tabs. However, I've not heard anyone actually say as to how you do this. If you are in an application, for example Pages, you are able to open multiple windows, and if they're not forming together in tabs, like in Safari or in the Finder window, you can click on the Window menu button and then click Merge All Windows. This then brings all windows into a tabbed interface. However, if you then open a new Pages document, it will open in a separate window, not in a tab. In order to force all of the windows to come into tabs, both in applications like Pages and in other applications across the Mac OS, if you go into the System Preferences and click Dock, and then about halfway down the item entry that says Prefer Tabs When Opening Documents, if you change that drop down box to Always, you will always have, even if it's just one window, will open in a tabbed view, and then as you open more windows, they will always open in tabs. This I found very helpful indeed. My second tip is a new feature that seems to have appeared in iTunes since, I think, two generations back. However, again, I've not heard anyone talk about it, and so I just wanted to mention it so that the listeners were aware, although I can't claim to have used it myself. And that is, if you right-click or control-click on a file in iTunes, whereas normally you would have the ability to enter the song, the artist, album, and so on, there's now a little drop-down box next to song, which is called Work Name. And if you click on that, instead of now entering the song name or title, you have three options. One for work name, one for movement, say one or four, and then the name of that actual movement. So for people that listen to a lot of classical music, such as myself, you'll be better able to properly and accurately apply metadata to your music so that in searching and creating playlists and so on should be much easier. As I say, I've not tried this myself, but hopefully over the next few weeks to months I will. And if there's any update that I can bring, I will indeed let you know.
Hey, great. Thank you, Sonal, for those tips. And I know you had a question, and just for anyone listening, I answered his question via email. So we're going to leave that out of this episode. But a couple of great tips. I did want to expand a little bit on that second tip related to iTunes. The dropdown Sonal is referring to is inside the Get Info panel for the song, and it's under the Details tab. So if you control click or right click on a track and choose Get Info, you get the little info box where you can start to enter in the metadata for that track. And then in the Details tab, which is the first tab, the very first box you'll notice, I think, is the song name. And the little label that says song title or name has a couple of little arrows on it or next to it. And if you click on the actual label, you'll see that you can change it from name to or song to work name. And when you change that, that's when you will see these additional fields for work name, movement, and name. And you can enter that additional metadata that's more specific for, say, classical songs. So if you have a lot of classical music, this is a great way to add that additional, very specific metadata. And I thought that was a great tip. So thanks for sending both those in, Sonal. We really appreciate it. And if you have a tip you'd like to share with us, as always, you can send us an audio comment or an email to maccast@gmail.com. One other fun thing that came in this week via email, David sent me a link to a Wikipedia article about the Apple car, but not the rumored Project Titan car. This is actually one that exists or did back in 1915. And 1915 was the first Apple car. So Apple is not going to have the first Apple car, even if they end up making one, which I'm not entirely convinced at this point they are. So the details on this, they're a little bit vague. I had to dig around, and even digging around for quite a bit of time on Google and Wikipedia and wherever else I could find information, I didn't find a lot of details. But I'll share what I found with you, and maybe we as a community can find and get more clarity and more specifics, because, you know, some of these connections are, let's just say, loose at best. But here's the deal, and I'm pretty sure of this one. There was a car called the Apple 8. It was an 8-cylinder automobile made by the Apple Automobile Company from 1915 to 1917. It sold for $1,150, and there was actually an ad that was targeting dealers to kind of sell this car, calling it a car which you can sell. That was like its big calling point. I think they were trying to get people to actually sell these things. The car maker is supposedly a guy named William Alfred Apple, or Bill Apple, and he was the president of the W.A. Apple Manufacturing Company in Dayton, Ohio. He became president after his father's death. And in 1910, the company was actually making auto tops for Henry Ford and the Ford Motor Company. So for, I would assume, like the Model T, something like that. And you can find information about the W.A. Apple Motor Car Company. I'll have a couple links in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to see kind of the starting point for this. But as I said, in my research, I learned some other things. It does seem that William could or may have some sort of connection or relation to a Vincent G. Apple, who was also in Dayton, Ohio, around the same time doing similar kinds of work, although what they made was electric ignition systems for Ford, and they also supposedly developed an electric car called the Dayton Electric. So Dayton Electric Company, there seems to be some sort of connection there. What that connection is, I couldn't find out definitively. So I don't know, you know, if they were brothers or cousins, or, you know, it seems like they are related. But Needless to say, in 1917, the Apple Car Company suffered some sort of bad fire, and that ceased production. So I don't think there's any of these maybe even left on the road. If someone knows of someone who has one, that would be incredible. I'd love to see some pictures. But wasn't manufactured or made for a very long time, if at all, and I doubt many of these things survived. But it was just funny to see, and David, thank you for sending this in, that, you know, we've been talking about an Apple car, and here's an Apple car, actually one actually that existed and isn't just sort of a thought or an experiment or something that, you know, could come to be. So thanks for sharing that. I always love hearing cool stories and history and stuff like that. And speaking of cool stories, that's what I've got for you next, because I have my interview with Scott Johnson, a good friend, someone I've known in podcasting for a long time. He runs Nerdtacular, one of my favorite conferences every year. And we sat down with him to talk about his production workflow, his artwork, a little bit about the state of the Mac and Apple for professionals, and also got into a little bit of Apple's entertainment strategy, specifically around VR, augmented reality, and stuff like that. It was a lot of fun to get him on the show. I probably need to do it more often. It's been way too long since we've had him here, but I'm not going to delay any further because I know this is becoming a longer episode, but I think you're really going to enjoy this. So here's my interview with Scott Johnson. Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I'm good, man. It's good to be back. It's been too long, I feel like.
It's probably been more than a year. The time just goes by so quickly.
Mm-hmm. And I used to think, when I was younger, I used to think that people in their 30s and 40s would forget that they hadn't seen you for a long time or hadn't called in a long time because they were purposely avoiding people, or they, you know, just had better things to do. But as it turns out, it's just because you're so swamped, you don't think about it. And it feels like you and I just talked, but it's like been a year and a half or something.
Right. Probably since Nerdtacular, and since that didn't happen this year.
Yeah. Skip right over it.
No, I've gotten you on the podcast, but I think something came up when we were on Twitter and you had mentioned that, you know, you had some things. Maybe it was, I have been on, show you do with Tom.
Yeah, you were on Current Geek. That's the last time we spoke there, yeah.
That's right. That's right. That's so true. I came on there, and then we said, hey, we need to get you back on the MacCast. So here you are. That's
here we are. You followed through. You're like, you're breaking all the trends. This is amazing. I love it.
I actually followed up. Well, because I was very interested, because I think you have some things to talk about in terms of, I think the last time you were on the MacCast, probably one of the things that we covered was workflows. It was probably, I'm seeming to remember, it was maybe around the time the iPad Pro came out. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of question about, you know, what's Apple going to be doing with the Mac and stuff like that. So I think where I wanted to start the conversation and bring back people back up to speed with you is maybe talk a little bit about, you kind of wear a couple hats. You have the podcasting thing and the podcasting empire that you've got going with like a million shows. You know, you got me beat there by a long shot. I don't know how you do it all. But then you also have the whole illustration art stuff. And I think people kind of know podcast workflows, so I don't know if we need to get into that as people listen to podcasts at least. But I'm kind of curious to get an update on what you're doing on the art illustration side in terms of workflow, and if that's changed a lot in the last couple years. So maybe talk about your current sort of setup and how you work and what machines you're running and that sort of stuff.
Sure. So I, back in, oh gosh, was it late or early 2015, I guess, or was it late? I don't remember now. Maybe it was late 2015.
We won't hold you to dates.
Yeah. I don't remember. I just don't remember dates, but I picked up I upgraded my Mac finally. I've been using a Mac Pro that I bought in like 2010 forever.
Right. Yeah.
And that thing lasted forever and is still working, but
the old cheese grater.
The old aluminum cool ones that they had where you could do a lot of customization for a while.
Right. Yeah. The big tower cheese grater ones with the handles.
The big heavy.
It's like you could, you know, prep some tacos on it.
Totally, dude. So that thing had seen better days in terms of, you know, just overall power and stuff. And I finally thought, all right, time to invest, time to get something else. And I ended up with one of the newer Mac Pros, the little barrel looking ones.
So you do have a trash can Mac Pro.
I do have that. Yeah, I do have that now.
Okay.
And it is awesome. I've loved every moment I've had it, with the exception of there was a bad video card that we had to troubleshoot for a while, and that ended up getting fixed and solved and ended up being a known issue and not a single issue since then. Never a lockup, never a reboot needed, nothing. Things been just rock solid ever since. Anyway, I really, really like it, and it's made everything I do faster. It's all SSD. It's all, you know, it's just as fast as it can be, even though technically the model hasn't been refreshed since, I think, late 2014. It handles everything I throw at it without any hesitation. That includes all the latest Adobe stuff, whatever heavy lifting I give it, it seems to be 100% capable of handling it. And that goes for the podcasting as well, the art stuff. So the art stuff continues to be, that is sort of my backbone. A Wacom 22-inch HD touch-enabled tablet, from their Cintiq line. And then, what else? Oh, and then, of course, the iPad and the iPad, or the iPad Pro and the Pencil have been this sort of new thing that I added into the mix. So it continues to be my primary platform. The Mac and the Wacom are the way I get work done for the most part. The way that the iPad Pro and the Pencil sort of fit in has been interesting, because there have been times where I need to be just on the road or somewhere where I'm not near my rig and I need to get that stuff done. And whether it's just quick sketches that I can then later dork around with on the larger setup, or if it's start to finish complete work, it pretty much can handle all of that. The only real downside is that the Adobe apps on the iPad Pro aren't exactly in the best possible shape yet. I think they could use some feature tweaks and some things like that. They're certainly not equivalent to their more full-featured desktop apps. And I'm relying on other art applications that are a little bit more specialized. Like I use, my brain just went blank on the name of the thing. It's called, Procreate.
That's a great app.
Yeah, been around forever. People have been using styluses with even older iPads with that thing. But it's super refined, extremely well suited to the Pencil and the iPad Pro as a combination, and making some really great stuff with that. That is easily my top pick for artist apps on the iPad Pro, especially if you have the Pencil. It's just insane how good that is. I love that app. So that's where I'll primarily create, master layered files, and those can easily be exported and shared via Photoshop directly to PSD files and things like that. A lot of really neat options with that. So it's kind of like this nice little synergy of I can create a lot of things on there. Sometimes it's just early stages and then do the finish work here. Or sometimes the entire process is done there, and then later I'll do all the sort of web posty stuff that I have to do with the websites and stuff on the other rig. And that's all worked out pretty well.
So
let me... Yeah, go ahead.
A question related to that. So you're saying in some instances you are going start to finish, like sketch to publish or almost publish on the iPad.
Yeah, ready to publish, basically. The only thing missing, and the truth is, I guess I could go all the way and just use, Safari and get into WordPress or wherever it is I need to put these things.
Right.
But as iPads have always been, and tablets in general, they're yet to be really great replacements for the kind of quickness you get with a mouse and a keyboard. And even with a keyboard, it's just not the same. So you just don't have the same sort of shortcut key workflows and things. So what's often easier for me is to get all that done, stick it in Dropbox, and the next time I'm in front of my rig, there it is. And I just grab it and do the final steps, which is, export it, put it up on the site, do all the posting, do all the social media,
so,
and not feel like I'm having to enter it all into a phone or something.
Yeah. So where I want to get to from a workflow perspective, and I want to ask you about, because I've struggled with this a little bit. I love my iPad Pro and I do a lot of my mobile work on it now, in terms of podcast prep and doing notes. I use Omni Outliner as my main thing, and they have a great syncing service and stuff like that. But often one of the challenges when you've got different apps, because you mentioned Adobe, you mentioned Procreate. So, you know, say you're starting out in one app or another and you're going back and forth and you're moving around. I mean, Adobe's tried to address some things with like the Creative Cloud and sort of syncing in with that. But I'm curious, you know, how does that workflow work for you? Like when you're going all the way start to finish on the iPad, are you juggling stuff around? And if you are, how are you doing that? Or are you pretty much staying in sort of one app and then just going straight to something like Dropbox, and that's how you pick it up when you're back on the Mac?
That's a great question. The Dropbox solution works for Procreate pretty simply. I'm done with either a finished or a partial piece of work, I can simply just hit share, export to PSD, hit the Dropbox button, and I'm done.
So are you doing all your sketching and your line work and your coloring and everything in Procreate? And are you like using layers there?
Yes.
I mean, how are you doing that?
Yeah, I'm doing all of that. In fact, one of the reasons I like Procreate is it's basically how I use Photoshop on desktop. It's got all the same features I would need for the kind of work I do. It's not fully featured photo editing or any of the things that you would use Photoshop for outside of artwork. It's funny because Photoshop as a artist tool is kind of weird in that it was never meant to be an artist tool. It has become that, right? But that's not what it was originally designed for.
It's a photo editor.
Photo editing and you know, graphic art that was different than your sort of freehand world. But it became that and is now the standard still for many people. And Procreate takes those best features and really fleshes those out. So what you really have is just a really powerful drawing tool, but not one that's meant for, you know, sizing photos or tweaking those, or, you know, messing around with photo work. Right. So it feels like it's almost like at opposite ends, but they really complement each other. Here's the nice thing about the Adobe apps that are on iPad Pro. They have a few features that I like. One, you mentioned Creative Cloud syncing and file sharing is really nice. But beyond that, the way I would use it when I do use those apps, like I'll use Sketch or Draw. Those are the names of the two that are on there that are kind of equivalent to Photoshop and Illustrator.
Right.
When I've created something in there, there's a button that you hit that simply says, send this to Photoshop. And I do that and I can be in front of my computer down here and it will immediately open Photoshop, open that file, and it's all ready to continue editing right now. I could be in a hotel and do that. And at home, my computer would go and up would come Photoshop with that and ready for me to edit and use it. That's really kind of awesome. And I wish Procreate had that step, but it's really just one extra step is all with Procreate. Procreate's just, you know, Dropbox, boom, it's in. Now the file's there and it's shared. So, you know, there's a little bit of a third party middleware thing happening. But,
so at least for your workflow, the lack of, because part of the reason I'm asking about this is one of the common complaints I get from people who talk about, you know, I really can't move my workflow to an iPad or anything other than a Mac, is this whole concept. And it's amazing that we're still struggling and arguing over this at this point. But it's the idea that Apple, you know, really doesn't have a Finder like file system for the iPad. And a lot of people find that challenging, especially if they're having to move between apps. But it seems like in your case, it sort of works because the workflow is more or less streamlined to a single app. Like you're not bouncing on the iPad between Procreate and Sketch, or are you? And if you have you found challenges there?
There are definitely challenges moving between those different apps. I mean, I wish that what I really wish for is that there was this thing just had a version of Photoshop that ran on iPads and that was equivalent roughly to the desktop version.
Right.
It's one advantage of, there's not many advantages in my opinion. We can get to some of this later, but the Surface Pro stuff from Microsoft and their Surface Pro Studio, which I've had some time to mess with this year.
Oh, cool.
I have a lot to say about Microsoft dipping their hand into that and what that I think means for Apple people. But my problem there is the tools aren't as succinct. Like there's laggy pens and they're a little slower and the pressure sensitivity is not great and they're okay. Surface Pro 2 was excellent. Then they dropped Adobe as their pen maker and the sort of the pressure technology they use was all Adobe. They stopped doing that and started using their own, and it's just not as good. So the 3 and forward is a little janky. But here you have a desktop version of Photoshop, and here you have a file system that's, you know, standardized in Windows and you can use in the way that we're talking about. So there's some real advantages to that that the iPad has never embraced. I keep hoping one of these days they're going to get up and say, and we're bringing, you know, some sort of file management system to the iPad, right, and just let us have, you know, even Chromebooks do this. They let us have a Finder-like place to put our files. And having messed with that a bunch this year, that reminded me that there's really no reason why they don't do it, except,
well,
I know there's an elegance to not having all that stuff there, but I don't know, man.
I think they had hoped that iCloud was going to be that solution. The problem was, is as often I think happens with Apple, is they release things and they're a little bit ahead of their time. Like, they get the cart in front of the horse, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And whereas iCloud, like iCloud Drive and all that stuff as a platform now is great and I think works the way it maybe should have at launch. There was some back-end stuff. There was developer API issues when they first launched it. And a lot of developers tried to buy into the philosophy, but it just didn't work. And so what you ended up seeing was developers turning to their own solutions. So that gave opportunities for things like Dropbox to come in. Microsoft did its own cloud thing. So if you use the Microsoft apps, right, you use Microsoft Cloud. I forget what they call their thing, right? Adobe built their own thing with Creative Cloud. And even like I was mentioning, you know, Omni, they really tried to buy into iCloud and it just didn't work. So they ended up building their own sync system. They call it Omni. It's called Omnipresence. And all of their apps sync with that. So then what happens is you end up with this sort of fragmented environment, right? Where it's like this app works really great with its syncing system and this app works really great with its syncing system, but none of them kind of all come together and talk to each other.
Yeah.
And now with some of the APIs with iCloud, you kind of can, but I'm seeing very few apps supporting that. So like for me, my fallback ends up being Readl makes this thing called Documents that sort of talks to everything. And sort of can act as this like intermediary. But even there, it's really clunky because you've got to, okay, I've stored it in this one cloud system in this app. Now I can pull it into Documents and now I can get it from Documents over into, you know, iCloud Drive or into Microsoft's thing all on the iPad. So you can kind of move things back and forth, but you're still doing these multiple hops and it just, you know, yeah, ultimately doesn't
it's
really
frustrating.
Work out.
I mean, if Apple would just make a definitive file transfer sherry thing that was just plenty of capacity. That's the other thing, is they want to charge for two-look capacity.
Yes.
That's ridiculous that we're still doing that. But if they could just do that across the platform and then anybody could access it if they decide to in their apps, then we're done. Then the whole problem solved and they won't have all this brand confusion or, you know, third-party confusion or any of this other stuff. You know, all that being said, I really like Dropbox. I'm glad it's a way I can do this. I've been using it for years and have an enormous amount of work that happens through Dropbox through various people that aren't Mac users or otherwise. So, you know, I don't want that to go away or anything, but I think they could go a long way to help. And that brings me to my other major point about this. They, with the iPad, it was weird. The iPad Pro and the Pencil seemed to be them saying, hey, artists and creative professionals, we haven't forgotten about you. We're not just making phones and mobile stuff and paring down our computers so they have no ports eventually and are kind of hard to use unless you're just casually checking email. We actually do still care about the input methods and the creative ways that you're going to use our hardware. That to me seemed like a really great sign. And unfortunately, as awesome as I think the iPad and the Pencil are, and it's by far of all of the devices I've ever used for pen, tablet type work, easily the best responsiveness, easily the best accuracy on lines, and the least amount of lag, and the best pressure sensitivity I've ever used on anything.
So that still holds true, because I think last time we talked was not long after the iPad Pro came out, and that was both our initial reactions. You obviously use the technology much more, and you're way more familiar with like the Wacom stuff, and now it sounds like the Surface stuff. So you still stand by that statement.
I absolutely do, and it's only after using, you know, a Wacom pretty extensively, various models of the Wacom, and they're easily second best, by the way. So just to throw that out there, Wacom still holds a pretty strong spot when it comes to that stuff. They really charge a premium for it, and maybe they won't soon after some of the other stuff we'll talk about today. But having used the Surface Pro Studio, I was actually very excited about that hardware. Mm-hmm. And it is what I like about the hardware is Microsoft's effort to say, hey, artists and creative professionals, do you feel slightly abandoned by your other platforms lately because everything's moving to mobile or different focuses and we've forgotten you exist? Well, we haven't, and we are going to have this initiative and we're serious about it. In fact, we have an entire 28-inch touchscreen display dedicated to artists. That was a huge thing for me from Microsoft, just from a company relations standpoint, me as an artist, Microsoft as a company.
Right.
That went a long way, given the fact that, Apple, on the other hand, seems to be going almost completely the other way. Mm-hmm. And not for artists, for film editors, for everybody else. They've put that, you know, they've definitely put their flag in the ground in a very different direction than perhaps, you know, where they started or where they were at their midpoint. I'm not saying that's a bad thing for business, just saying that's not good for me as an artist. And so right. I was really excited about that device. The problem is it's not that great. It's sloppy, choppy, and really slow. Lag sucks. And yeah, it's not great. It's okay. I'm not saying it's a terrible piece of hardware, but my Wacom performs better and my iPad Pro performs way better than any the example of the Surface Books or the Surface Pro.
And for the type of work you're doing, I found it interesting that you mentioned, you know, that Mac Pro actually came out late 2013.
Yeah, no, it was the 2013 like, model, and I bought it in 2015 or
something.
Yeah,
you bought it in 2015, so you've got two-year-old technology in there, but it performs. And this is the constant thing that I hear is, you know, a lot of people are very critical about the age of the machine, but I talk to a lot of professionals who have bought them, and I have yet to hear from somebody that, oh, yes, I'm extremely disappointed. And maybe I'm just not talking to the right kinds of pros. You know, maybe I need to talk to the guy who's trying to you know, do the film editing or the coloring for, you know, like a major Hollywood film, and they'd feel different about it. But, you know, a lot of the professionals that I'm talking about professional photographers, I'm talking to illustrators, guys like you, people who are doing, you know, production work and logo design and you know, the typical sort of desktop pro, and maybe even up into podcasters or people who are doing, you know, YouTube video sort of work and those sorts of things. They all seem to be very, very happy still with that platform.
Yeah, I don't have any desire to change that part of my stuff. It is a little concerning that there have been no major revisions to that device since 2013 when it was released.
Super concerning, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. But it was already concerning. If you remember coming into that before that announcement, we weren't sure if we were going to see a Pro again because they had taken since, I think it was 2010 was the last revision to the Pro line, and it had been ages since anybody had touched that thing, and everybody was like, I don't think we're getting a Pro ever again. I think maybe it's IMAX forever and we're gonna have to figure something out.
Yeah.
And that was also about the time that Final Cut started being a thing they didn't care as much about or shifting their focus with it, and you know, some of their other tools that used to be industry standard, and Adobe picking up the slack on all of that. And and by the way, it turned out to be a good thing for me. I love Premiere. Love Premiere. I think Premiere is amazing. And I think Apple stepping out of the way a little bit actually gave them a far better platform as a result. They've really been hustling on it. But all of that being said, despite the fact, I'm at cross purposes here, because despite the fact that it came out in 2013, I bought it in 2015, and now we're in 2017, and there's still no revision in sight.
Right.
It runs so fast. It's faster than a PC I've got that's less than a year old that is maxed out with everything, including a top-end video card for gaming. It's faster than that thing at the things I use it for.
Right. That's the important key, though. That's the other thing I think about this complaint is, you know, Apple's never done really high-end GPUs. They've never really done, you know, like that machine is designed for a specific kind of professional.
Right.
I think, and if you move outside of that sort of target range, that's when you start hearing the complaints. Like I was saying, you know, the guy that's trying to, you know, render the next Pixar film is going to hate that machine.
Right. Yeah. Right? No, totally
right. Or the pro, you know, the pro gamer who's trying to compete with his buddy who built a $2,000, you know, gaming rig from scratch.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, you know, in the PC side of things, there is a pattern of, ooh, new video cards are out, I got to get one. Ooh, new CPU bumps, I got to get that new motherboard, I got to blah, blah, blah. Like, you're always trying to tweak that thing out, even on ones that are less custom and ones that are, you know, kind of solid, more solid state, like from Falcon Northwest or somebody.
Right.
You still look at it and go, well, what's the latest, what's the greatest, what's the latest, what's the greatest? And part of the reason that you're always in that cycle is because the latest that was the latest isn't necessarily the greatest and never was, and there was always something around the corner anyway. Apple tends to go, all right, we're going all in on this thing. It will be expensive. It will be overpowered for its time, and it will last whoever buys it 12 years.
Yeah, it's their workhorse machines, right?
It really is. And I mean, I had that other Mac so long. I have a 2006 iMac upstairs that everyone's still using for everything. Like, it's ridiculous how long these things live.
Yeah, we have a 2009, and I have a 2006 Mac Mini that is, you know, it's relegated to become just a server. I use it for, you know, backup, archive backup, and things like that. But, I mean, that thing never is turned off. I mean, it doesn't even have a display on it. It's just hooked up to a Drobo and just sits there and chunks away forever.
Yeah. And I've had various PCs during that time that are dead, that have long been dead, dead for years, dead for 5-6 years, while I still have Macs that I bought around the same era that are still running. So there's no denying that. I've had enough experience with them knowing that this thing that I bought is not, you know, was expensive by any measure of the money, but has lasted me already longer than a PC of equivalency would have. Right. And I'm okay with that. I'm totally cool with that. Where I have concerns is it's just not a priority for Apple on the artist side anymore. And it's a very specific case. I realize that this is me talking in a minority group. We are not their market. We certainly are part of their heritage. We are certainly part of the notion of what Macs are and where they've always been, and artists always preferred the platform. We've always been the faithful, but they now deal in world's largest market cap, giant markets of phones and portable units and notebooks. Right. And it's just a different thing now. And so when they do throw us a bone, I get super excited. I think the iPad Pro and the Pencil were absolutely that. What I really want from them, though, is an equivalent to the Studio that Microsoft's putting out, but with the kind of refinement that Apple is known for. Right. And give me a giant screen to work on with the kind of fidelity I'm getting out of my iPad Pro, with the Mac OS environment that I already love and prefer. I mean,
So here's something I've been thinking about a little bit. I haven't really shared with anybody yet, and this rumor's been around for a while. But knowing what Microsoft did, knowing sort of your desires there, you know, that you just stated, and looking at one of the things I've seen a lot of Mac Pro users do in the last couple of years is they've moved to iMacs. That 27-inch, you know, 5K iMac has become sort of the substitute for a lot of people for, like, the trash can Mac Pro. Mm-hmm. It kind of feels to me like if Apple is going to continue in it with a quote-unquote pro machine, the next step does seem to be something like a Surface, and I'm sort of thinking like a 27-inch, you know, 5K, 8K, whatever it might be, iMac, almost like an iMac Pro. Right.
Yeah. More, but some of the things that the iMac has been losing over time, and like notebooks, more so on notebooks, but the iMac continues to lose ports that we need. It continues to be restricted in what I can tweak, change, or add on to it. Mm-hmm. I really like that simplicity when that's all I need it for, but that's not me in this case. I need more ports. I need more stuff. I need it to handle USB 3 and USB-C. I need it to be, compliant with devices that I need to add to it and that work well with it or whatever. And so, like today, there are certainly people that make the decision mostly based on money, but make the decision to go with like a 27-inch iMac over a Mac Pro with decent specs. And the reason they do that is mostly price. But they give some stuff up. They're usually hybrid drives. They're not pure SSDs in most cases.
Right.
So you end up with a slower deal. You don't have as much memory capacity, even if you max it out. You don't have the CPU capacity or multi-core capacity, and a lot of the other things that the Mac Pro ships standard with. So if you're really serious about the hard, heavy lifting work, it's almost like you don't have a choice.
Right. This is what brings me back to this idea of an iMac Pro. With maybe a touchscreen kind of thing, maybe some of that technology, maybe you merge in the internals of the Mac Pro with an iMac, combine that with the drawing capabilities of an iPad and throw in some extra ports, you could have a really...
It'd be like, huge. It'd be enormous. And make that your first touchscreen Mac. Like, you could go nuts.
And it's
like,
highly it's so- targeted, you know, and it's not saying we're getting into touchscreen computers in a large scale. It's going to be very pricey. It's going to be targeted at a very specific end of the market that can benefit from that sort of feature on the desktop.
Right.
You know, for everybody else, get an iPad Pro.
Right. Right. And everybody,
you know, there's your consumer version of a drawing touch tablet Surface.
Sure.
And I don't know. You know, I'm spitballing here, but it's interesting to me, especially like you're saying, considering what Microsoft attempted to do, and they got that community very, very excited. Mm-hmm. I'm a little disappointed to hear, you know, your impressions. And I think I've read some of this as well, you know, that it the concepts that are there are great. The execution maybe fell a little bit short.
Yeah, let's see what version 2 is, because this is a case of it's just a little underperforming power-wise. It doesn't have the precision that artists are going to demand if you're serious about it.
Right.
But the effort is noted. Like I really appreciate them doing this, not only just to kind of shake the market up a little bit, but to remind Apple, yo, this is your space, and right now you don't have anything in there. Like, you don't have...
Right. They've left an opportunity.
They really have. And not only that, it's a big enough one that a corporation like Microsoft doesn't just make a willy-nilly decision like this. They clearly see that there's a place for this, and they see there's a place for switching here. And they're also the most platform agnostic they've ever been. So they benefit anyway, no matter what, because they've got great stuff happening on iOS, and they have great stuff happening on macOS, and they have great stuff happening with their own hardware and their own Windows platform. So they got nothing to lose. They can just really go for this. Meanwhile, Apple's still got sort of the same, you know, they're in the same position they always are, which is, you know, stay within our space, stay within our ecosystem, and we'll take care of you. But if you're not taking care of them in this one way, that's potentially a lot of very influential people that could shift over. And I have to admit, it was really tempting. If that thing would have came out of the gate awesome, like amazing precision, whatever, whatever, that may have been me jumping ship.
Your next computer.
Yeah, they could have done it to me, but they couldn't quite pull off the hardware.
Do you think, and I probably know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. Do you think there's more professionals in the same place that you are?
Oh, I definitely do. I think that there are a bunch of people like me who, I mean, there may be more in the movie editing world. I talked to a director the other day in Hollywood who's just has spent years frustrated about how Apple just seemed to leave those guys behind with the Final Cut world.
Right.
And they all had to get, you know, behind Adobe products. And most of them, I shouldn't say most, maybe a huge chunk of them, including him, moved to high-powered PC platforms to do all their editing.
Right.
And that's
happened. That's already happened. Like, Apple's already lost that battle. Mm-hmm. And I think the battle that we're talking about here is more guys like you, illustrators, page layout artists, you know, the real working core people who were the core of Apple's business through all the hard times. You know, we were the guys that were dealing with OS 9 and all the crud going on there and those gloomy years. You know, we were the ones that sticking through. And sure. Yeah, Apple's maybe moved on from that. And maybe computing in general has moved on in a big way from that. But it's still what Steve Jobs called the truck market, right? There is a truck market, and there are Mac users in that market that are looking for an Apple truck, and Apple hasn't been delivering them. And
I don't know if we're going to see that change. I always feel like Cook and company.
Well, they keep saying they are. Like, yeah, do we believe them at this point? Like, how long do we take them at their word that they care about this market?
That's a very, very, very potent question, and it means a lot in the future, I think, for what Apple is and what their image is, at the very least, not alone who their let alone who their customer base is. But I really want to see something out of them soon. We just got word at CES that Dell, of all people, are getting onto this bandwagon. They're releasing something maybe at the end of this month called the Canvas, and it's a great big 27-inch. Standalone art unit. It's more akin to like buying a Wacom in that regard,
right?
Because it can be used with any PC and any Mac, and it looks amazing and is something like $1,200. And along with that, there are about 20 Chinese manufacturers that are all making drawing tablets of various kinds. I mean, there seems to be an uptick, a new rise in this and an interest in this. And those are all very inexpensive and in a lot of cases, total garbage and junk. But nonetheless, I think it's a signal that this is about to take on new life and this space is looking for leaders. And I think Microsoft wants to be a leader. I think Dell in some ways wants to. I think others certainly do. I know Wacom wants to maintain their foothold, right. But I don't see anything coming out of Apple where I want it the most. And it's frustrating. I'm not going to count them out yet. There's still time. Sometimes they're late to the game and then best at it because they waited. But I would really like to know what they want to do. Is it just phones forever and that's just the way it is or what? You know?
Yeah, it seems like a critical year for me as far as this goes. And I guess where my concern is coming in is that we're, you know, practically on March here, and there's nothing in the rumor mill that we're hearing related to Pro Max beyond, you know, the MacBook Pro.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with you. 2017 is a big year for this, and it's, I don't know, when do we get our first conference with them? Is it this month, sometime in March? Apple right. gets does yeah. whatever.
And we're not hearing anything about desktops. You know, I would expect that there would be some updates to iMacs, you know, just in terms of processors and things like that. I don't think we're going to see any huge form factor changes.
Do you think we get
the MacBook's kind of overdue, and who knows?
A MacBook Pro refresh, or not MacBook, a iPad Pro refresh this early in the game, or do you think they're going to let that?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely slated for March at this point. So, brand new iPad Pros, there's going to be a new size sort of form factor.
Ooh, if they did a big, huge one?
It's actually a 10.5-inch display that will be the same size as the 9.7 in terms of physical size.
Oh, the bezel will just be, okay. Yeah,
edge to edge, no home button, that sort of thing.
That's kind of neat, but what I really want is
a 15-inch.
Yeah, I want a big fat one that I can just, I mean, I basically
again,
just
want, yeah, that's the artist in you, right? That's the, yeah. I want a huge drawing surface.
I want a lightning cable that to my Mac and use it as the desktop tablet, and right. then I want to take it on the road and use it like a pro. Like, that's what I want. And they're not going to give me that, but that's what I want.
Right. Well, there's that software that lets you do that, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you use that app.
I have. It's pretty good. They started charging per month for it, which is weird. The one I was looking at anyway. And it worked really well. I did the trial, and I was super impressed with it, but it was also kind of redundant for what I do.
Right. Because you have the Cintiq.
Yeah, there's no point in having the Cintiq if I'm not going to use it, but I could see that totally working for people, especially if they required it. That monthly fee is not so bad.
I can't remember the name of that app. I'll get it and put it in the show notes for people, though. There's an app where you can literally cable your iPad Pro to your Mac and then use it as a drawing surface in Photoshop and all those sorts of things like a Cintiq.
It's pretty neat.
Yeah, I've heard good things. Yeah. So... last thing I kind of want to hit with you, and then I want to talk about maybe some cool stuff that you've run across lately, you know, sort of stuff that you're into, what we call the things or thing of the moment here on the MacCast. But, you know, one of the other things that we're hearing a lot about, and I know you're into like gaming and you have gaming PCs and rigs, you know, mm-hmm. VR, augmented reality, we've been hearing a lot about that from Apple. Typically, Apple doesn't play in the sort of game entertainment space, but we're sort of hearing a lot about augmented reality. What's your take on that? Is that stuff you're excited to see from Apple, or are you sort of like, hey, we've got like really cool stuff from HTC and Oculus and all these other companies? So,
well, it's funny you accurately say that Apple doesn't usually try to stake any claim in the gaming space or whatever, but sometimes they just fall into it by accident and end up dominating it. And they did that with the App Store in a way that is
with iOS.
Yeah, it's breathtaking how they upset that market nearly overnight. Like, it's just crazy. So sometimes they get that stuff right without trying very hard to do it. And there's also a lot of problems with it now. That is one of the most bloated stores in the history of ever, and it's very hard to find things. And, it's a problem you want to have, but anyway. I think that they're counting on, unlike HTC and the Vive or Oculus or the more high-end approach to VR, and I have a Vive here that I got for, you know, so I could know what this stuff is going to be about.
Right. Real quick before you get into that, what's your take on it?
I really like it. I think that it delivers on what we all envision VR might give us in terms of creating virtual spaces. Nobody's really nailed a killer app yet. Honestly, the best thing I've used on VR is weirdly Google Earth. And a lot of people are like, how is that possible? It's the weirdest thing. If you've never seen it, you got to try it. You just end up plopping yourself down. As you know, like Google Earth has constructed actual polygonal reconstructions of the zones and areas you're in.
Right.
So if you're in New York City, when you look at Google Earth, you can zoom down between, you know, crudely rendered, but still, you know, buildings and Times Square and all that stuff is there. This lets you walk around in that and jump up and go somewhere else far away and stand around Southern Utah and all these like Monument Valley and like crazy stuff like that, Red Rock formations, and then jump over and be in Seattle and stand by the Space Needle, or go hang around your own neighborhood. And it is surreal. It's not just flat imagery. It's this weird, junky, clunky looking odd world. I've never been so blown away, but that kind of thing is what VR has accurately rendered and done it in a way that's very impressive. But that stuff weighs a ton. It costs too much. And it's, you know,
well, and I think that's part of Apple's problem. I mean, Tim Cook has come out pretty publicly and said that, you know, VR doesn't seem to really interest Apple too much. And I think part of the reason is it's an application thing, right? It's like Apple's big deal is they are really about the experience. And as cool as what you just described is, right? It's virtual vacations. It's sort of, you know, and you do it once or twice and you're like, okay, that was really cool. But the utility of it versus, you know, I think they've said augmented reality is a big thing. And we just heard, I think just today, that supposedly they have 1,000 people working on augmented reality in like Israel. And that they're going to bring some sort of application to the iPhone. We've been hearing about the iPhone having these special sensors to do, you know, like 3D rendering and depth perception and all this sorts of thing, all to tie into augmented reality. So the idea would be, you know, like a map where you're actually seeing as you're walking around stuff, and now you can find services and products and things overlaid on top of that. I'm assuming in some sort of, you know, who is it? Scoble seems to think that Apple's going to release some sort of glasses accessory that would tie into all of this. So you'd wear some sort of lenses, and we've even heard about them looking at things like contact lenses that would actually be able to display information.
Yeah, no question that augmented reality is way more Apple speed. A lot of predictions I hear are mixed reality, where the eventual outcome of all this will be something that will render both virtual space and augmented space interchangeably. And maybe, but that's all.
What do you think? You know, like, we're getting into sort of this Minority Report territory. And I guess my big concern there is like Apple will open up the APIs and make all this stuff available, and it'll all just be advertising.
Yeah, no, I mean, right? I mean, yeah, like it very well could be. So these posters are talking to you when you walk past them and whatever. Like, yeah, for sure, there's like all that stuff is really uncharted territory. Like actual use case has yet to be proved to anybody outside of, well, this is fun and this is cool, but nobody's made like a game you want to spend 12 hours in right now on the current platforms. It just doesn't work that way. I think these are the three factors that have to happen. Cost has to come way down. So this needs to be like a $100 item that somebody buys.
Right.
It needs to be wearable wirelessly, lightly, and not look like a big dumb thing that blocks the world out. That has to be number two. And number three, there needs to be killer apps for it, or software that you can't live without. It needs to basically follow the pattern of notebooks and then tablets and then phones. They all had these bumpy moments of like, wow, look what this can do, but sure is kludgy, isn't it?
Right.
And then look at it 20 years later when it gets refined. We're at that kludgy point, I think. It's like voice recognition in the 90s. I remember being blown away by that idea. I remember it not working hardly well at all. Right. That translator stuff is all garbage. But it seemed at the time like we are on the cusp of something rad. And then it went quiet for a long time and a lot of work got done. And now they're all around us and we use them constantly. And you can tease, you know, SIRI and ALXEA all you want. Trying to help your listeners there.
Right.
But you can tease that technology all you want. But the truth is it works. Like it really works. And it works really well. Well, it took a while. those big overheating tablets in the early aughts that Microsoft made with Windows XP on them, they were an amazing idea, but they were big, bloated, hot, disgusting, heavy machines. It took another 10 years and suddenly the iPad is a thing and then tablets work. Like, it's the same with phones, it's the same with everything. Right. So we're in the kludgy time. I hate to say it. We just are. And Apple usually doesn't get in at that time. They wait until it's not kludgy. The only time they haven't waited to get into something kludgy was when ex-Pepsi guy was running the company. He liked to get into kludgy stuff fast.
Right.
But, you know, as much as I have fond memories for the Newton was a kludge. It just was.
Ah, it was great. But yeah, it was so far ahead of its time. You know, it was the iPhone, like you said, 10 years before there should have been an iPhone.
Right. Or it was the, it's kind of like what a, I don't know, like a Trio was before the iPhone, or what a right. an early model BlackBerry was before iPhones and Android. It just is, it just wasn't its time, yet it was a spark there and you knew it. You knew something special was happening. You just didn't know when it was going to really truly reveal itself. And I feel that way very strongly about AR and VR. It's going to be a slow road, but we'll get there. And when we do, it'll be affordable, it'll be fast, and it'll be something we need and not just think we want.
Okay. So one other thing on this, just, and this is a personal thing because I'm kind of curious. It's something that I've been doing more and noticed doing more, and I'm curious if you do this as well, because I know you're into iOS games and things like that, but you're also a hardcore gamer.
Sure.
Do you have an Apple TV?
I do.
Do you play like games on your Apple TV? I'm finding that I'm actually starting to do this more. I have one of these Nimbus Steel Series controllers.
Same one I have, yeah. I love that thing.
Do you play stuff on that, or is that really just kind of a, like a distraction?
Well, it's definitely not where, I mean, it's not the platform where your big AAA title is going to come out, but
right.
it's definitely a fun platform to play. I do play, to answer your question, I do. I use the Nimbus. That's a great controller, by the way. I think it's the best of the MiFi controllers. That are out there for iOS or for Apple TV. And I use it interchangeably between that and my iPad Pro. That makes a great combination as a controller and screen for some games. There's a game called Neon Chrome that I absolutely adore. Ooh. Plays really great on the Pro, and is it's kind of this dual stick shooter thing, roguelike, that I just, oh my gosh, can't get enough of it, but I love it. But it's great. It's a great casual platform for games. I don't know if I'd call it a game console, but I guess it kind of is.
That's the thing, is for me it kind of is becoming that. But you keep in mind, my last game console was a Wii.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's yeah. the space I live in terms of being a quote-unquote gamer.
Right. And I think that there's a huge unserved audience like you, and maybe they're even being served and they don't know it. They're Apple TV users and they just haven't bothered to look deeper into what they're device is capable of. I think one mistake Apple made was including a remote that sort of pretended to be a controller that isn't very good. I think that controller's a slippery mess. It's way too sensitive. You're skipping past stuff you don't need.
I will say ours has hit the TV at least once already.
It's kind of a pooper, that thing. But they have an opportunity there. They could really go further with that if they wanted to.
I guess I could invest in their $20 strap or $10. I guess I think it's only $10, but still. Right.
And name another. I mean, as Sony did this a little bit with their crossplay with the Vita and the PlayStation 4, but no other platform has as much crossover. So you can take your phone and play a game and have that syncing to a cloud save, and then open the same game for free because it didn't cost you twice
right.
on your TV and continue playing there. I love that.
Yeah, like, that's I love that too.
It's a great thing. And they did that kind of quietly without any fanfare. And I don't even know how many people really know that they're doing it, but it's a fine device for that. I would not poo-poo that at all. I think you're using it maybe better than other people are. I think enough people don't give that thing enough credit for what it's capable of outputting. It's a fun game machine.
And it took me actively sort of seeking this out, because I had bought the controller and I hadn't really done much with it. And then I decided a couple of weeks ago, I'm like, wow, I should really see what kinds of stuff is available, you know, that uses the controller and takes advantage of it. And I was actually frankly surprised by some of the titles that I was able to find. And there's some interesting, you know, fighting games going on, and you know, I think there's a 3D tank game and that I haven't tried yet. And I mean, there's lots of things happening there. So if you want that sort of stuff, it is a platform. And I think what triggered it for me was at Christmas time, I was in the Apple store, and unfortunately for this poor kid, I think, this lady comes in and says, do you guys have a, I think she was looking for a Wii or like a Wii U. She didn't really know what her kid was asking for, but it was a gaming platform. And the guy's like, no. And then I was like, okay, just stop there. You know, stop there, like send her off to Best Buy or whatever. But he doesn't stop there. He's, but we do have the Apple TV. Do you want a demo? And then I kid you not, like 30 minutes later, I see her. She's got an Apple TV. She's got a couple Nimbus controllers. Like, she's got a full setup.
That's great.
It's great, except
it's, I mean,
knowing the kid has asked for a Wii, like a Wii U for Christmas. I'm like, I don't think this is going to fly on Christmas morning.
No, it's not. I mean, the truth of it is he may actually, at his age, he doesn't know it yet. He knows what he thinks he wants, but he may actually like that better. He's
gonna that's the thing. So and that's sort of what triggered me going, hey, I wonder what kind of gaming experience I could actually get. And for me, it does kind of match in a lot of ways what I had with my Wii. You know, it's very similar titles. I don't think that Lego's put its games out on Apple TV yet, but now with the new, you know, they just upped the, they had some restrictions that I think was sort of limiting it in terms of, you know, how much could be downloaded at any given time. And I'm hoping that's going to sort of open it up a little bit more as a, I was going to say less casual gaming. I mean, it's a casual gaming platform, but there's more opportunity there.
Yeah, for sure. And they're not known for maximizing their game potential, even when their app store is as dominant as it is in mobile gaming.
Right.
And even though they make deals with Nintendo and have the cloud to do that and all the stuff they do, I still always feel like, oh, you guys are just half-assing the game stuff. You could go all the way here. You've got a huge, foot planted in this. It's just almost like they don't know how to do it. I don't know. It's weird.
Right.
Apple's weird with games. They always
interesting
have
to see if they do anything with the next-gen Apple TV. I mean, there are rumors, as much as Cook has sort of come out and said, no, we're not doing VR. I mean, there are rumors that at some point, maybe an iPhone gets powerful enough to, you know, do wireless. You know, you buy a little $99 accessory like, is that the HTC one where you slide your Android phone in, or that's some, I can't, whichever.
No, that's
the Samsung.
Samsung Gear is basically, it was co-developed by Oculus, but it's a completely separate situation. But yeah, you slip it in
something
there.
Like that for the iPhone and Apple TV.
They make those now. You can go to Amazon and buy VR phone holders that you put over your face and you stick an iPhone in and it works.
Yeah, but then it's just, I mean, then you're just talking about like Google Cardboard kind of stuff.
It's not, there's no customized, like, I don't know, some would argue that Gear VR is just trumped up cardboard anyway.
Is it?
I don't know. I mean, it's nowhere near the desktop solutions, but I'm a big believer that VR ultimately needs to be mobile. It cannot be tethered to a giant box on a desk with you there by yourself. Right. It's just stupid.
And Apple, any company that could pull it off, because Apple is in charge of designing the chipsets and sort of building the platform, if they, like you said, if they ever just decided we're going to go all in on this, I think they could pull that kind of system off probably more easily than a lot of other companies.
Completely agree. They certainly have the money for it. I mean, they've got all the R&D they'd ever need. There's no reason Apple couldn't lead in that place. The question is, do they think it's a valuable place to lead?
Right.
And I don't know. Because right now, I'm not even sure the VR industry knows. There was so much hype leading up to the release of these three marquee headsets, the PSVR, the Vive, and the Oculus.
Right.
And now that they're out, you got your early adopters are all good, but it hasn't spread like wildfire. They're just, you know, price prohibitive.
Yeah, I think it's price prohibitive. And I think, like you were alluding to earlier, sort of the application, it's the titles and the software in a lot of ways, too. It's like there's not been sort of this killer app yet.
Yeah.
You know, and I hate that cliche term. Yeah. I hate that cliche term, but that's the reality.
But that was true. It's been true of everything. So I think they'll get there. And it does sound cliche, but I'm totally with you. It's just, sometimes you got to build the thing and then something magical will happen on the thing. But right. That doesn't always coincide with launch day.
Yep.
Unfortunately.
Yep. All right. I want to finish up with one other thing. Hopefully I warned you enough on this. But here on the MacCast, we do kind of what I call the thing of the moment. It's just whatever sort of iOS, Mac-related software, hardware, whatever little gadget thingy app you're kind of, you've discovered recently and you're just kind of into and enjoying. I mean, it's really as simple as that. So
I like this kind of stuff. I've answered this for you before. I don't remember. I never remember what I've said previously, so hopefully I'm never repeating
myself.
Doesn't
matter.
Can happen. Yeah, for me, it is probably, I could probably go either way on this. Probably going to say that it's.
And I'll let you do more than one if you can.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I guess there are probably no rules here as far as that goes. For me, it's probably an app I can't stop playing, a game specifically. And I don't know why I'm obsessed with this. Here's all you have to do on the App Store. All you have to do is say, use the keywords RPG or the word roguelike. And I kind of auto buy whatever it is you're making, even if it's garbage and Apple has no return policy on a $3 game. But
right.
At any way, with the hope and faith that you made something cool in genres I love. And every once in a while, I get really lucky in that regard because there are a ton of those things I just described on the App Store. A lot of them, and they range from shovelware garbage from, you know, Korea somewhere to actual quality video games. And I found this thing called Tavern Guardian.
Ooh.
Tavern Guardians. And imagine a match 3 battle system, but the whole point of it is you're trying to protect a tavern from being attacked from a bunch of monsters and eventually bosses. And combining arrows means you damage things. Combining money means you have gold for upgrades between matches. It's always go as long as you can before you die. When you die, you can go spend your money on improving your skills, or your health, or your armor or whatever. So the next time you play, you've got a slight advantage. You can get a little bit further, which is kind of the definition of a roguelike. And it's just a delightful freaking game. I can't stop playing it. So it's called Tavern Guardians, and I love it. It just came out. It might be only a few days old. And I want to say this was $3. So no free-to-play garbage tied into that, which is kind of nice. So I like that a lot. My other thing I would recommend, and this is certainly nothing new, but I don't know. I'm just so into it right now.
Right.
Is this goes well. All right. So if I'm running on the treadmill, it's easier for me to take my phone, especially because I can also do Amazon Prime with this because they don't have the app on the thing. I AirPlay everything now, I feel like. I'm just like constantly AirPlaying off my phone. And I don't know if everybody else is like that or not, but it's something I really enjoy. And then an extension of that, since that's not really that big a deal and everybody does it, but I just feel like lately I've been AirPlay Joe.
No, you know, I don't think everybody does. And I think a lot of people forget about the usefulness of AirPlay. It's funny. I'll give you a quick example, because I went with my daughter to a gymnastics meet in Idaho this past week, and I was smart enough to think, oh, I'll bring the Apple TV in case we want to watch movies or something like that. I have an old Apple TV 3. And so I brought it along, and of course I do the dummy thing and didn't bring the remote,
right?
Which means there's no way to connect it to the Wi-Fi mm-hmm. in the hotel without the remote. I'm like, oh, well, that stinks. Mm. Except I pull up AirPlay and it's like, oh, you can AirPlay. So like anything that's on my iPad it works just fine. You know,
yeah.
I didn't need the Apple TV interface. I could still AirPlay to it.
Yeah, it's a piece of amazing technology and should be used by everyone always. And so certainly
I even forget about it.
Yeah, but it's easy to, right? Like you're like, oh, crap, we're not going to be able to make this work. And then you realize, oh, no, this will totally work. I watched the whole Super Bowl that way, and nobody knew the difference. It was nice HD on a big TV, and it was all coming from my phone. But anyway, so there's that. But then this other thing I've really gotten into, which is kind of a little weird, but I'll admit it. Fine, whatever. This is a public podcast. I like to draw on my iPad Pro with the pencil in Procreate while I have a little minimized multitasked video window from, you know, like picture-in-picture video window from Hulu while I watch The Golden Girls and draw. So I have this like little, it's bigger than, you know, I don't know how big it is. It's probably right. Like a 2-inch by 1-inch or whatever. The smallest one you can make. And I just have that up in the corner playing and I kind of glance at it. It's like having two screens. I don't know how many other people do that. It doesn't ding performance at all. So I can watch all my streaming favorites. All the major streamers now offer picture in picture on the Pro. So it's not, you know, you can do it with Netflix or Amazon or anything, whatever. And that's great. I freaking love that. PNG. Even though somehow I was sure I wasn't going to use. I'm like, how am I even going to ever, like, when will I watch a video and do something else? And I found a way. So I like that.
That's cool. That's a feature.
I don't know why the Golden Girls. I was kind of into the Golden Girls when I was younger, and I, for whatever reason, that's a thing right now.
Oh, yeah. Nothing wrong with that. My biggest disappointment with that sort of thing is a lot of times you can't even find that content. You know, it's like these great old shows, and you think, oh, God, you know, Netflix has to have paid for, you know, like all the episodes of Knight Rider or something like that. And I haven't checked on Netflix if they're there or not, but or Amazon. But oftentimes I'm surprised when you can't find stuff. You're like, come on, you know, like. Yeah. What can it cost to license these great old shows? And I don't know if they're just holdouts from, I'd love to know the economics behind, you know, sort of what gets on a streaming service and what doesn't, you know, like even old movies. Like there's a terrible old Christian Slater skateboard movie called Gleaming the Cube.
Oh yeah.
You can't get that on streaming. You can't buy it. You can't, like, I've come very close to just resorting to pirating it because you cannot get that thing anywhere.
Yeah. Oh, by the way,
and only I would care about that. You know, it's sure. It's got Tony. It's the whole plot is terrible, and it's just I love it. I'd love to see that film again.
There's a reason we haven't film sacked it because I don't think we can get it streaming anywhere.
You know that movie though? Huh?
Yeah, it's on our. We have this list of all time.
He's got like a Korean brother, and somehow he's, I think, wrapped up with some sort of Yakuza type gang or something like that, and Christian Slater's this skateboard punk kid who's like his, you know, stepbrother or whatever, and he's gotta,
I remember
like, save
seeing
him.
It everybody it's as bad as it sounds, everybody, it's not good what you're describing, but you know, like, why isn't Gilligan's Island somewhere? That makes no
right,
sense to
yeah
me.
yeah
I don't get it. But Knight Rider was on Netflix. They pulled it recently. They lost the thing, so for a while there your Knight Rider dreams were coming true, but not now.
Yeah, I don't understand. I wish I could figure that out. But anyway. All right. Well, I am going to let you go. I want to thank you so much for your time. This has been awesome to have you back on the show.
Fun being here. Fun talking to you. Always good catching up on this stuff. And it's also just fun to follow the evolution of how this stuff affects the way we work with somebody who, whenever I check in, that we get to do that. And I feel like I would get a little data point every time we talk. So this right. is good.
And just in case there's someone in the podcast universe who doesn't know about Frog Pants and all the stuff you do, you want to tell people about some of your shows and the things that you're up to, maybe where they sure. can check out your illustrations and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. If you like, you like comics, you like art, you like illustration, you like, shows about movies and TV shows and nerdy stuff and video games. And how about a morning show 5 days a week? Well, and all you got to do is go to frogpants.com. All those projects are there. And you can find all of it, including the artwork and the comic that I've been doing for 15 years straight now. That's always being updated. So go check that out. That's frogpants.com or follow me on Twitter. And I talk about a lot of this stuff there, at Scott Johnson.
Right. And then I'm looking forward to seeing you at Nerdtacular this year. I think it's sold out. So I'm kind of teasing everybody because I get to go and they don't. But
yeah, the tickets went in a day, which has never happened before. But it's our 10-year anniversary. Big community get together. Adam's been there nearly all the modern incarnations of it, and yep. always fun to see you there. I suspect this year is going to be as fun as ever, and it's the last major one in this format. We're making some changes in the future, and so we don't know exactly where we're going to go from here, but because of that, we wanted to have at least one big version of what we've always done and really blow it out, and it's going to be rad. But for people who didn't get tickets and you want to see it, that same place, frogpants.com or even nerdtacular.com will have links to live a live stream of the entire thing. So there'll be a way for everybody to watch it
virtually for free.
Totally.
Yeah, you should check it out. Great panels on comics and video games and all kinds of nerd stuff. And I'm assuming you're doing the Battle of the Frog Pants All-Stars like trivia thing that Brian Ibbitt does. And it's so much fun.
In fact,
a lot of board gaming for me, too. That's a big reason I go.
Got to figure out a way to get you. Oh, yeah. Plenty of board gaming this year. That's a big focus. But I'm trying to figure out a way to get Adam into the All-Stars competition in a much more official way. Because I just like to see you have to sweat like us up there. I think that'd be great.
Well, I would. I'm in. If you could find a way, I'm in. But
all right. You got it.
Cool. Well, thanks again, Scott.
My pleasure, dude. Glad to hear you're doing good. And stay out of the floodwaters, will you?
Will do. Talk to you later.
Talk to you later, man. Bye.
Hey, so there's Scott. If you have not checked out Frog Pants and all the great shows he's doing over there, one of my personal favorites is Film Sack, where a bunch of guys take a movie, they watch it, and then they go over it in a really fun way. It's kind of a little Mystery Science Theater 3000, but not in real time kind of thing going on there. And it's typically, you know, more of your B-type movies, or in a lot of cases, a lot of the stuff that I loved watching in the 80s that you go back and you look at it now, you thought it was so great when you were a kid, and you look up at it now, and it just really doesn't quite hold up. And those are kind of the funner episodes when they're doing Film Sack. So they kind of, as they call it, sack a film. And that I would definitely recommend, or check out The Morning Stream with Brian Ibid, which is an amazing show as well. I mean, there's just a whole staple. Whatever you're into, it's nerd, geek, pop culture stuff, they're probably going to have some episode or some show for you. So if you're looking for a new podcast, that's definitely a place to check out, frogpants.com. And with that is going to do it for us in this episode of the MacCast. I hope you enjoyed it. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. And of course, check out Text Expander for Teams. You can get more information and details on everything that Smile does and is doing at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media, and they are at BackbeatMedia.com. As always, if you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you're welcome to send me emails and audio comments. You can send those to MacCast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Leave your voicemails there. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at MacCast.com. And if you'd like to follow me between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. That'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.